The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning. 3.5 minutes past nine this Friday, the 10th of March, 2023. How are you getting on? You're very welcome along to another edition of the 9 till noon show. And it is a Friday, which means very shortly I'll introduce to you our Friday panel and we'll get their views on some of the big stories of the week, and we want you involved in that conversation as well, of course. 074-91-25000 is the number to call. Caroline taking your calls today. You can WhatsApp and text the show as well, 086-60-25000. And if you prefer to watch the programme, get straight onto our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland. You can watch on your smart TV, Fire Stick or an app. Same with Facebook, and it's on your tablets and all that kind of stuff as well. All right, so there's no excuse not to digest us one way or the other. All right, let's introduce that panel to you. First of all, Catherine Noon, lawyer and former Fine Gael senator. Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good morning.
Great to have you back on the programme. We also have Eamon McGee, former inter-county footballer and columnist. Good morning, Eamon.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
Very good. Thanks very much, Eamon. And last but not least, Brendan Byrne, who's currently the CEO of the Irish Fish Processors and Exporters Association. Brendan, how are you getting on?
Not too bad, Greg, and good morning to you.
Great to see you. Great to hear from you as well. Okay, let's start with news that Taoiseach Leo Varadkar said the government is not for turning on its decision to lift the eviction ban, even if there's a massive increase in homelessness in the coming months. He said an extension of the moratorium would not solve the problem, and instead the government would look to other solutions. If there's a massive increase in homelessness, he said, then we have to figure out the best way to reverse that. The government decision to end the ban on evictions will be the subject of a Dáil vote on Wednesday, the 22nd of March, after St Patrick's Day, because they're on their hollybobs now. Sinn Féin housing spokesperson Eoin O'Brien confirmed this afternoon that his party will have a private member's motion debating the previous day, or debated demanding that the government reverse its decision. It's a hot political topic. I think this break for St Patrick's Day is a welcome rest bite, though I doubt it's going to be let go. And, I don't know, the government's in kind of a catch-22, damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. So this is obviously fantastic for the opposition because they can get their teeth into them whichever which way. Catherine Noon, government right to lift this eviction ban, even in the knowledge and acceptance that it is going to leave all different types of people without a roof over their heads.
It's a very, very difficult one. I mean, I think the government have really struggled with the decision to, but they appear to have made a decision that is the one that most experts in the property area would agree with, that really having the eviction ban in place hasn't massively improved the situation. There are those who would say that it would have been worse if it hadn't been in place. But really, the overall situation between landlords and tenants, it's very broken in the country, as is the whole property situation, as we all know. I mean, we're talking about it day in, day out. There are improvements being made, but it's hard to see them because I suppose there have been a lot of external factors that have come into play, including the situation in Ukraine and our welcome of Ukraine.
But Catherine, I'm not obviously clearly not an expert, okay? But the eviction ban has been in place. It does mean that people have not been thrown out onto the streets. But in the interim, we've kind of done nothing to prepare for the inevitable end of the eviction ban. For instance, one of the biggest complaints landlords seems to have is the high rate of tax. In other European countries, it's down around 7, 8, 9%. Here, it's over 50, 51%. You know, do a bit of work in that regard or something. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
It feels like nothing has been happening for half a year. We bought ourselves some time and we're still at the same point we were at the beginning.
And the point that you make is totally valid. And it's a point that I've been hearing on many of the discussions on this issue in the last few days from property experts and, you know, representatives of landlords. And they have been making that case for years. And I'm an accidental landlord myself. And, you know, it is a pension for when you're older. But on a day-to-day basis, if you were very calculating and clever about what you do with your money, being a landlord is not a good idea, you know, and tax-wise, there are no breaks. And,
does it depend what you want for it? Because it seems that a lot of the vox pops that you hear, landlords are upset they have to pay towards their mortgage. Do you know what I mean? If this is your pension, is it not? Yeah. Not and when I say this is your, I don't mean yours, right? I'm speaking in general.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're expected to contribute to it yourself. A lot of what I'm hearing is people are upset that now they're having to put €200 or €300 a month towards their, their property. But then I also understand that the way things are going, they feel they've got no control over that property, that, you know, that can they liquidate it ever if they wanted to? So I do see both sides.
Well, it's two-edged, and I think that's very fair comment from you. I mean, at the end of the day, it's not so much paying towards the mortgage. It's the overall picture when it comes to tax, you know. So if somebody earns minimum wage or medium wages, say, and they're a landlord, they're taxed on their income and they don't get any breaks for the mortgage being in existence. So it's not as simple as them not wanting to pay towards their mortgage, although that is a way to look at it. But I mean, you know, I'm not here to defend landlords, but I mean, there is a perception. I mean, I heard somebody on the radio this morning talking about how the word landlord really would need to change, because in a way, the word in itself makes it seem like they're somehow superior to tenants.
It's a dirty word now, there's no doubt about it.
You know, and it's like in the same category as developers and lawyers and politicians, of which I, you know, I'm ticking a lot of boxes. But you know,
I just want to say at this point that Catherine's a landlord, a lawyer, and a former politician. Just try cutting me.
But no, yeah. So you know, I'm triple scum of the earth or whatever. But you know, at the end of the day, there's so much negative press around that. I mean, at the end of the day, it's individuals who, a lot of the time, we have obviously massive corporate landlords. But
we can't expect landlords to fix the property crisis.
And you're right, going back to your point about policy. We have had time to implement policy that would make it more advantageous, and you wouldn't have as many landlords fleeing the market. Mm. So, and that's an actual fact based on statistics that I've been reading and listening to over the last week or more, that, you know, there's been very intense conversation around this. So, you know, it's as you say, it's a fundamental issue of policy when it comes to landlords. And I think that we have been, in a way, a little populist in how we have, the government has been, in a way, a little bit populist in how they have responded to the wishes of or the lobbying of those who represent landlords and those who are in who have property, because the perception is that because you're a landlord, you're somehow, you know, so much better off. But that's not the reality, you know.
Not all the time. Okay, Eamon, what do you think? I mean, what's your views on all of this?
I think you started off there. Is it the right thing to do? And I think we have to stop looking at that in terms of what's right and what's wrong. For me, looking at it, we're bound by the markets in reality. We have to accept that. You know, we've limited control over in terms of how we react to things and what provisions and what measures we put in. But at the end of the day, we're bound by the markets. And, you know, I think ultimately the thing is broken. I think that we're reacting rather than you know being operating from the front foot, and you know, I don't have the answers. I'm not knowledgeable enough.
But what confuses me, Eamon, is if I were the government's one of their advisors, a job I would never take on, but I'm sure there are many, many of them, I would say, right, if we're going to come with this, we have to come with something else. We have to come with something for the landlords. We have to come for something with the renters. You know, you would not simply announce an end to this eviction ban. You'd want to say, right, we recognise the challenges with landlords, so we're going to look at the taxation element of things, or, you know, and give something to all parties. It wouldn't make it all go away, but it would be far easier to go on radio shows when you choose to do so and answer questions, because you'd be seen to be actually recognizing the challenges.
You would be seeing what I also and I recognize what Catherine is saying there, in terms of we shouldn't demonize the mm-hmm. landlord, and that seems to be the way things are going, and it's this nearly nasty word, but it's very hard when a large percentage of TDs are landlords and they're operating from that mindset. And maybe it helps in a way, but it definitely doesn't help for the optics of the situation in terms of how they go about addressing the situation.
And the truth is that, you know, if we were to open the phone lines here now and invite landlords to come on and fight their corner. They wouldn't, because as soon as you'd put your head above the parapet, it would be knocked off. Or someone would say in the street, "I heard you on Highland, do you think this, that and the other?" That is sort of the dirty space, not literally is, but that landlords probably feel they're in, or some people see them in.
Exactly. If you're going out for a few pints at the weekend, you know, you wouldn't admit that you're a landlord. You'd just keep the head down for...
Would you admit you're a politician first or a landlord first?
You would admit you're neither of them.
I'm joking, Catherine.
I'm having an awful time. But just on your point there, I mean, it's not as simple as to say that because TDs sometimes own property. Like, you could say the same about TDs being farmers or TDs being close to fishery, or, you know, it's not quite as simple with respect to say that. Mm-hmm. Because if TDs were having the weight of influence in the landlord space, then the policies would be in place that are really favourable to landlords.
Yeah, but if you've got a ministerial... If you've got a ministerial table and a third of them have a dog in the race, at least, you know, whatever the reality, the perception's not fantastic. You could also say, there's not much, doesn't seem to be much happening to fix the health service. But then I'd say an awful lot of politicians have private health insurance. You know, the heads of the HSE don't trust the health service. They have got their own pride. So a lot of it's about perception.
I think it's more to do with the optics of the situation. In terms of, like, when they have a dog on the race, as Greg says, it's very easy for people. Sorry, go on.
They're not having the influence on, you know, so if we go back to the salient point that's being made, which is that TDs are, you know, some of them are landlords, you know, well, you know, they haven't actually affected massive change in favor of landlords. So it kind of lies,
The situation is so bad for landlords that the amount of TDs that landlords have gone down from like about 38 to 26 or 7. And now all of a sudden we're doing things to try and make sure we don't lose any more landlords. But as I say, it's probably perception and optics. I'm chomping at the bit here to get Brendan in. Brendan, come on.
Sorry.
Sort this out. No, it's not. No, it's lovely. It's brilliant. I just want him to sort it all out for us.
The first thing I would have to say, as a result of the change in the eviction ban, there's 3,000 families potentially that would be either listening to this or around the country that are fearful of their future. But there's also 11,500 people of this country already homeless. We have an incredibly broken system, and we have gone from a country in the noughties that could build 60,000 houses a year to a country that can't build any houses now. And when you have a system that's incredibly broken like what we have, then radical decisions have to be made. Now, the eviction ban, in fairness, is a matter of serious concern for those that are renting. We appreciate that. Now, we also have to be mindful that the eviction ban was a temporary arrangement, and that's at most that it could be. Now, there are those that are trying to reinvent the reason why it was put in the belief that in the 3 to 5 months that it was there, that we could somehow solve the housing crisis. We are now in a housing crisis that will be with us for the next 5 to 10 years. That's the reality. And what I'm very disappointed about is how the government are not using the toolkits that are available to them to accelerate the rate of housing provision. You know, modular
such as what? Modular homes. Okay, go ahead. Yep. I was going to look for examples. Home. Yep.
And I was watching the debate last night on Question Time in the UK. They are years ahead of us in what they're going to provide in modular homes. Here we are with a deficit of 200,000 houses, thinking that we're going to deliver that through conventional means of developer-led, maybe local authority-led. We're fooling ourselves. And yet, if you look at the toolkit that I was on a local authority, you have emergency powers that invested with the county managers for accommodation provision. Usually it's used for traveller accommodation. There's nothing preventing that to be used for ordinary accommodation. And we have a government that's still funneling all their energy to conventional build. You will not get the rate of build through conventional means to tackle this housing problem. And the debate, you know, if you look at it, I, in preparation for this here today, I watched the Taoiseach on the Dáil on Tuesday, the Taoiseach yesterday, and we're not in the right space for debate here. You know, we are a country that is a crisis. You know, in the 80s, we lost our young people because there's no jobs. We're losing our young people now, and they're emigrating to other countries because there's no housing. We need to have a fundamental debate, and it needs to be treated as a national emergency.
Yeah, so in other words, what you're saying is that almost a cross-party acceptance of the situation and that this is not about what you're doing in government now, what we might do if we're in government, but treated as an actual emergency, like we saw with the emergency in health, for example. Is that what you're saying, Brendan?
Exactly. And when I did an assessment from an apolitical basis of the debate on Tuesday and Wednesday in Dáil, I was very disillusioned because the government are doing what governments do. The opposition are doing what opposition do. Yeah. Meanwhile, the problem is there. And the problem is getting very bad and it's getting worse by the day. And until we get into a space and a mindset that this is going to take extraordinary measures in order to deal with the crisis, it's not going to get any better.
And I agree with you because, you know, like there's always going to be an element of the population that will experience travel or go work abroad. But I'm sick and tired of seeing moms and dads saying tearful goodbyes that they don't want to on social media, but they're having to, and they're having to advise their children to leave because they believe that's how they have the best options. Eamon, I mean, Brendan's hitting a very important point there, isn't it? You know, it's not just, which is incredibly important, the 12,000 homeless and the many more that are couch surfers and all that but aren't caught in the figures. It's really the state of the country as a whole.
Yeah, and I get that. I actually had this conversation at the weekend about, you know, people we've seemed to, out the back of the last major recession, we lost a generation and we seem to be heading that route again. You know, there's a lot of people heading away, and housing is probably a big issue amongst young people that are heading away. And there's a lot of options. Do we talk about changing the culture in terms of where house ownership is seen as, you know, there's a lot of places on the continent that, you know, rental is accepted.
But you see, the thing I think when we discuss that, Eamon, not you and I, but the country does then, you have to say, right, that's fine, but then what do we do when people hit retirement or get to a certain age? You know, how will they be able to afford to continue to pay rent? And, you know, like, if we're going to, and I agree with you.
That, but we should be having conversations rather than just being reactive, be proactive in terms of, you know, do we have to change the culture here? What do we need to, in terms of modular homes, in terms of whatever. Now we have to reframe the argument, because if we keep hitting our head off the wall here, like we're failing in health because we just keep going around in circles. We're failing in housing because we keep going around in circles. So we need to kind of step off the track here and reframe the argument, reframe the terms of how we look at it.
Yeah, but it's kind of depressing, that, isn't it, Catherine? I mean, you know, you were when you in your time in politics. I mean, obviously, there's certain things you can influence, and we can sort of mess around the ends and all that. But the big fundamental problems that have been hit on by Brendan and Eamon there, I don't see any pathway to a resolution, really, because I don't know if our political system is set up in a way to effect meaningful change.
And that's quite a potentially deep conversation about how our political system is set up, you know, how we have proportional representation. So, you know, there is a need for politicians to sometimes be all things to all people so that they remain in a job. And, you know, you can get into a very deep argument about that. But I want to go back to something about that Brendan said about, you know, and I'm very impressed with the way Brendan approached his thinking on this and how he studied it during the week and the conclusions that he's come to, because with Sláinte Care in the health area, there's an effort there for it to be cross-party. And I was actually, as it happens, at an event on a property business kind of thing last night in Dublin. And the one thing that a man contributed to the conversation, who's been in the business for 50 years, was that there needs to be a cross-party approach to this. And the Punch and Judy stuff, you know, it really gets nobody anywhere, only it kind of made maybe gets people more upset about it than they are already, you know. So, I mean, as you said quite rightly, Greg, you know, the opposition do what the opposition do and the government do what the government do, and that's the system. So, you know, it's really to move above that and to realise that in a way this needs to be approached like nearly wartime, you know, an emergency response that, and there are efforts being made that are, you know, significant, but I think the way it plays out on the national airwaves sometimes it's counterproductive, you know.
Yeah, Brendan?
Well, what's lacking, as I see it, is political leadership on the issue. Mm. We're going to have to, in terms of this problem, and it's unprecedented in scale, you know, when did we ever think we have a housing crisis of potentially 200,000 houses needed? And if we're going to stay on the trajectory that we are, which is conventional means of delivery, it's not going to happen. And I can't understand why the Minister Dara O'Brien, hasn't pushed harder in terms of modular homes. All of Europe is doing it. And perhaps there's a misconception of what a modular home is.
Well, is it possible? Let me just throw this out there, right? Because some people will be listening and say, is it possible that contractors in the business of pouring concrete and breeze blocks and what have you, that perhaps have really good access in terms of lobbying, are saying, well, hold on a second, we can't really switch to modular home building. There's other people doing that. We can't approach things the same way. Could we have people within construction, for example, lobbying against such a move?
It's unlikely, and from what I have gathered, what's lacking here is political direction. You know, there's going to be no one fix solution to this. We need to approach this from a multi-aspect point of view, where we provide houses through conventional means. There's a time delay there. Best will in the world, you're talking 12 to 15 months per unit. Modular homes, if it's properly organised with the right incentives in place, you can deliver in 6 to 10 weeks.
What would you do about planning?
Planning, as I said, under the emergency powers of the chief executives or former county managers, I think there has to be a serious national debate that the power is now invested in the managers in locations where there's a critical housing need, that he grants it, and that will circumvent NIMBYism and all such things.
Catherine,
because that's a huge issue, actually. Yeah. Sorry to cut across you, Greg, but that, you know, everybody wants housing. But when you talk about the reality of where the houses are going to go, people don't want them beside them.
Well, it's the same with wind farms, if we were to believe recent studies. But let me put it to you, and then I want to bring Amy in on this. We're hearing 60-odd school projects now are being deferred because of rising costs. Road projects, some question marks on them as well. You know, a few healthcare centres aren't progressing as they should. You know, squabbles over contracts down the country or whatever it might be. It's the mood music doesn't sound great to me. Are we easing into a period of where we're not investing in things like schools, health centres, and dare I even say housing?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the day-to-day reality of building has become very difficult for, you know, those who are professionals in the area, as well as those who want to get the jobs done. So, I mean, I personally am involved with a project where the costs have gone up probably about 60% since we started out, and we're only talking about a fairly short period of time. And it's as though contractors are so busy that they give in a quote that if you go for it, it's a bonus, but they don't actually want the work.
They're pricing themselves out of the jobs. They're setting the target whereby they couldn't say no, but they're happy to say no. Yeah,
exactly. And there's a lot of that going on, even with like Bord Gáis is involved in this particular this particular project. And, it, you know, the builder said, you know, that basically it is because they don't want the job. And there's a bit of feck off in the quote, which, you know, that's a huge problem. And there's so much demand for people to do work. And, you know, I think that the whole, you know, the word broken has been used a few times this morning, and it seems a bit basic, but, you know, it definitely is quite broken, because how do you fix that? Yeah. Do you know, what's the solution to that?
Well, Eamon,
you know, it's going to affect schools. It's going to affect everything, because this price price gouging going on. And I said to somebody recently who's in the building game, you know, oh, prices will have to start to level off or come down. And he, the simple phrase he said was they won't, because too many people are making too much money.
Eamon, right back to the beginning before we take a break and move on. At the heart of all of this is the 12,000 people already homeless who the chances of them getting accommodation now will seem as far away as ever. People... of all, I don't need to use the emotive scenarios, but we know people who need a roof over their heads not being able to get one. They're going to be chucked out. You know, landlords, I mean, I have sympathy for them, right? But they've got an asset that they can liquidate at worst case scenario. Do you know what I mean? So my heart is not breaking in that regard. And then we're seeing a depopulation, I think, a lot from rural Ireland, as Brendan pointed out for the beginning. Like, it's a, when you take all the strands and they're all interconnected, it, we really need to start hearing from the powers that be some solutions here. They owe us that, and maybe us as a people need to stop listening to these pointless debates in the Dáil or on the radio and actually just wait for, you know, actually, hold on a second, not interested in you scoring a punch, not interested in you get one over Pierce Doherty or over Micheál Martin. What we actually need is to stop your crap talk, with all due respect, and actually start giving us some solutions and some answers.
100%, 100%. You know, personally, from my own point of view with regards to housing, I think it should be a constitutional right for each person to have a roof over their head. Doesn't even have to be their own house. They should have a roof over their head. Now, that might be too far left of the spectrum economically to be for a lot of parties in this country, but that's where I personally come from. I accept that's hard to get to, but it just goes back to the point, you know, this is a crisis. The word's broken, and how many times have we been using this over the year? The crisis, the broken, the system's broken, and, you know, people firing over back shots back and forth in the Dáil, and it's just no good to the people that are, you know, that are sleeping rough through no fault of their own. So it's, I don't know, Greg, if we've come looking for solutions to this debate.
No, but I think it's what it is actually, it's very useful in that we're all have, you know, all of us, it's a reality check. And then we've got the strange situation whereby the council are out there currently bidding for houses to house refugees, and maybe people are saying, oh, it's handier to do that because I can chuck them out whenever I like. It will cover some of the mortgage and I don't have the complication of rent. Like, I'm not even bringing that into the conversation, but that's, you know, that's how crazy the system is. Brendan, do you want a quick last word before the break?
Well, the reality is for the last decade, we're running at a housing deficit and there's an accumulative effect, and we see that. And I am going back to the same point. Conventional solutions are not going to work here. And this haphazard approach of the present government and the previous government has shown its results. It can't deliver houses by conventional means at the rate that's needed. And until we have a holistic approach here that brings in emergency measures, that pushes the boundary, and we're not good at that in this country. For some reason, we are not good at crisis management, but we need to get into that space immediately, because if we do not deal with housing, we are facing the highest level of unprecedented recession because of a housing need.
Yeah, I take exactly what you're saying, but we only have to look back a couple of years to when we treat something as an absolute emergency, all hands on deck, legislation passed in minutes.
Sorry,
go ahead, Eamon.
When
any of you come in as you see fit.
To throw out that figure again and emphasise the figure that Catherine's thrown out there in terms of 60% rise in costs, and how scary that is for, as you as a young person going out to build, or, you know, anybody dipping their toe into that market. And for me, that's terrifying.
And that's if you can get planning permission to build on your own property. Okay. Stay right where you are. I think really interesting contributions, as always, from Catherine Noon, Eamon McGee and Brendan Byrne. Back with more from them in a moment. Now, Belong To, the organisation representing LGBT young people, has expressed disappointment at calls from the Catholic Primary Schools Management Association for children not to be taught about transgender issues. The CPSMA said teaching primary children what it means to be transgender would require to teach something about which there is neither a scientific nor social consensus to highly impressionable young children. Educating children about trans issues could help trans children feel safe and included in their school, said the chief executive. Now, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has personally backed primary school students being offered education about what it means to be transgender, but with the caveat and the stressing of his opinion that a clear parental opt-out should also be offered. And that, I think, just to further flesh out what he said, he says, look, trans people exist. And in school, it's about learning, and you teach them that's the case, but you don't necessarily have to say whether it's not right or wrong, but you know what I mean, to sort of dig any deeper on that. This is an issue that is difficult to talk about. Everyone has opinions on it. Some have concerns, but don't go all the way in terms of the concerns that other people have. It's a complex one. It's a difficult one to talk about, sure, but we'll see how we get on. Catherine, would you be comfortable with transgenderism being talked about or taught in primary schools?
Absolutely. I mean, 100%. I mean, if we're to take guidance from a Catholic Church, nobody would be divorced. People would be in relationships that they weren't happy in, you know, because that's Catholic teaching. We would still not allow, I mean, they still technically don't believe that gay people should have, you know, relationships. I mean, you know, it's interesting to start the conversation with the Catholic Church. And it's obviously a good starting point to the conversation. But I mean, what the Catholic Church think at this point should not dictate what's taught in school.
But
in my opinion.
The reason why I did is because I think that an awful lot of parents, and it's another one whereby people perhaps don't want to speak publicly because they'd be seen as a bigot or something. I think there's an awful lot of people out there, I couldn't put a percentage on it, that would have applauded what that organisation has said. That's why I sort of, you know,
yeah. Might not be... No, by all means, and I completely understand. I mean, I'm not being critical of you introducing that into the conversation at all. I mean, I respect the premise of this conversation, but the Catholic Church, I mean, I'm Catholic, I identify as Catholic. I was very involved in the, you know, I had, I suppose, a leadership role on the Eighth Amendment. And, you know, I learned a lot about the human condition during that process. And, you know, what really is very important to remember is that life is not black and white. And the sooner that you can teach children that there are nuances and difficulties and you know, less easy paths that some people have in life, the better. And I think there's a fear that somehow if they know about transgenderism they might become transgender, or, you know,
but it's not necessarily that. But what about the concern that some may have that as you mature, right, that life is confusing. You know, your estrogen levels might peak, your testosterone levels might peak, they might sway backwards and forwards, okay? And in that point, you're looking for a hook to hang your hat on. Now, in the past, you just worked it through, right? What about parents' considerations that some might feel that you could be planting something into their minds? And there, again, and I want to reference the fact that we are living in a time now where it's never been more difficult for teenagers. Record levels of teenagers presenting with mental health issues, self-harm. And I don't think we've ever talked more about mental health and tried to care for our young people. So something what we're doing right now is not working. So is it possible that unless we get this right, we could be contributing perhaps to more mental health issues in teenagers as they get older? That's not my view. I'm just trying to represent things that I've heard out and about.
No, absolutely. And I actually agree with a lot of what you're saying. And I can see why parents would be concerned. And it is a difficult one. You know, raising a child is a difficult thing. You know, while it's easy enough in the sense that they need food and they need shelter and, you know, joy in their life and love, you know, that it's not easy. And society, as you say, you know, it has become very challenging, and there are a lot of mental health issues, as you say. And, you know, there's a lot of statistics to back up the fact that transgender and homosexual children struggle at a greater degree. So it makes, you know, that I presume that this whole conversation, you know, has somehow emanated from the stuff that has gone on in the Midlands with Enoch Burke, and that's been on. We've been subjected to that on a daily basis. But if you think about the child who's at the centre of that, you know, that's who I'd be concerned about. You know, this is all a bit of a sideshow, bit of drama for it to be shown on RTÉ at the night time. And what's Enoch Burke up to now? And, you know, there's all sorts of T-shirts and crazy stuff up on social media about him. But, you know, at the heart of that is a child who's really struggling. You know, and who every day is reminded of this struggle, but because of this. So I think education for children in general to be more accepting, but at the same time, there is a fine balance, you know, at delicate stages, like you say, where, you know, children are discovering their own sexuality.
Yeah, because in there somewhere, you have to teach children to recognize their own identity and to have resilience. You know, but are we doing that? Or are we just throwing another ingredient in there and not really considering the potential implications and afraid to do so because it might upset some people. But we'll come back to you. I want to bring Eamon in. Thanks, Catherine. Yeah. No, I'm just want to make sure everyone comes in.
You can take this one, Catherine. We don't mind. Me and Brendan will just sit on the sidelines for this one.
Go on, Eamon. What
typical,
do you think?
Actually, that's typical of even the debates on, you know, men are like, oh, I don't want to know, you know, but.
exactly.
Yeah.
Go on, Eamon. What's your view?
I think the question that was asked at the start is, you know, in terms of for primary kids to be introduced to that. Now, I would again, like Catherine, take big issue with the Catholic Church lecturing us and anything in terms of what we teach our kids.
Okay, well, let's put that to one side.
We'll put that to one side. But the question
pretend
is,
it was a different organisation.
Yeah, right. The question is, are we comfortable with introducing this to primary level kids? Now, I think we've got to introduce it at some stage. Now, in terms of how much do we open their eyes to this? What level are we taking them down to here? Because it's a new world. We've got to chat to them at some stage about, you know, homosexuality, about transgenderism, and despite what people want to say or, you know, put themselves in.
Can I just say one thing, just because both of you have said it. There is many people in the homosexual community, let him put it like that, that aren't actually fully comfortable with constantly being attached to transgenderism either.
Yes, and for me, that could be another
debate, but that is, you know, I think maybe straight people will, you know, and there's no harm in it. I'm not saying either if you're doing anything wrong in doing so, but I just want to recognise the fact because it's been said to me and I agree. There's quite a cohort within the homosexual community as well as in the straight community that are not fully comfortable with constantly being. Not linked, because that sounds... Do you know what I mean?
But the point I was trying to make in terms of an individual sexuality is not black and white.
Yeah.
You know, and we need to talk to our kids about this. You know, the days of saying to her daughter, like, you're going to have a boyfriend when you grow up. Your days are saying to her son, you're just going to have a girlfriend when you grow up. We have to broaden their perspectives.
Do we, though?
For us just to limit them, and then they have these kind of conflicting emotions. Well, I'm supposed to stay
but
in
we
this
guide
lane here.
Yes, but we guide them in every way, right? We guide them in every way in life to make sure they don't cross the road or dangerously. They don't do that, and they look to us for us to take them by the hand in a certain way. Now, I'm not equating any decisions they might make in terms of who they are partnering with as to crossing the road, but. You know, I presume, because we're told at an early stage you can see signs and maybe you can adapt how you speak to them at that point. But are we past the stage where we say to we joke with an 8 or 9 year old, have you got a boyfriend at school? Surely we can't. Do you know the way people do the teasing and all that?
No, I know, but it's how we're not. So we can still say stuff like that there, but we just can't limit them.
Okay. No, I get what you're saying, and the thing about this is, as you see, we're all in. I think a lot of this stuff really should actually be up to parents to teach. Now, what happens is a lot of parents don't teach, and we know that with the birds and the bees and the consequences of that. Brendan, I want to come back because this is developing nicely in terms of people's points of view, but I want Brendan's point of view on this one now as well.
Well, the first thing I have to say is state the obvious. We have a tendency in this country for the last 15 years to burden teachers with more and more responsibilities. And the amount of work that has been transformed into teaching that's otherwise, as I see it, because the primary educators, and you correctly said it, the primary educators are children, are parents. The professional and principal educators are teachers. Now, as a parent, I would have severe difficulties in what exactly has been proposed here, because let's look at what we're talking about. We're talking about 4-year-olds to 12-year-olds. The Enoch Burke story is a secondary school is where you're talking about teenagers. So as a parent, yeah. As a parent, I'm wondering, has a teacher a right to talk in terms of transgenderism or anything before my child has reached puberty or sexual maturity? That is the debate that we need to talk about. But we're talking in a vacuum, because in actual fact, we're talking about transgenderism, and I appreciate and I respect the fact that we have to educate our children about that. And that's a moral responsibility on me as a parent and on us as a society. But what exactly are we talking about? What has brought us to this point is a Minister of State announced we are going to teach transgenderism and we're going to do it at primary school. I spoke to teachers and I asked them, what's that involved? Don't ask us.
Well, Brendan, before you continue that, see, this is another thing. I wonder how many parents of children, primary school children, actually know what their children are being taught about anything to do with sexuality. Like, how, you know what I mean? Like, a lot of people are up in arms about this, and that's fine, and that's why we're talking about it. But I wonder, do they know what already is being spoken to their children about and how it's being spoken to them about?
Well, if they don't, they should. And it's a very simple way of finding out. You check the textbooks that these children have. You ask your child, well, what are you being taught? That discussion needs to be happening. I assume that that discussion is happening. It certainly happened in my household. But, you know, we as a society get a headline, transgenderism has to be taught, and we all funnel into different types of arguments. You know, what are we talking about here?
Well, I don't think we've settled on that yet as a populace.
Well, I'm actually impressed this time around, because I was following the commentary on social media, and I think you touched on it yourself, Greg, when the Catholic Managers Association issued their statement. It actually was very well received, because usually, in fairness to that organisation, anything that they would say would be hammered. But on this occasion, it wasn't. Yeah. So I think that reflects a genuine concern that there is out there. And I think we need to just park Catholic Church views, because that's divisive. We all have our own views about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's an institution that's in flux and always has been. Yeah, because
it is much more deeper than that.
Yeah, because there's a lot of people that wouldn't describe themselves as Catholic or straight or whatever it might be, that everyone has different points of views.
Yeah.
Catherine?
It's like anything, I think, Greg. Timing in life is everything. And I think the point about primary and secondary, I missed that nuance in the argument, to be honest. And I mean, it's a difficult one. And at the end of the day, when you were talking about resilience in children, you know, that's going to come from their home. And, you know, an awful lot of education is coming from the home. And really, our teaching of sex education over the years, especially in Catholic schools, has been quite conservative and limited. Mm-hmm. And there is a need to address that. And we covered a lot of that over a number of years when I was in politics, you know, in the whole women's rights area. And, you know, it's a very potentially broad debate. But at the crux of it, it's about timing and when it's appropriate, really, to start having these conversations.
Yeah, okay. And, but Eamon, like, parents are going to have to... go ahead, Catherine.
The nuns didn't show us our videos when I was in Mayo in school until sixth class, which is when you're just going into first. Now, I actually don't know exactly what happens with kids now. We certainly didn't have a textbook.
Do you know, the only thing I wish, the only video I was shown in school was of an abortion, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah,
same as that.
Yeah, I didn't see anything to do with the birds and the bees.
In the context
of don't do it, this is what actually happens. And that's one of the strongest memories in my mind. Yes, Brendan.
Wouldn't it be more appropriate to be teaching about safe sex and, you know, anyway, listen, you get me on my hobby horse.
Yeah, Brendan.
I must have went to a very good primary school, because
Sorry, it wasn't a primary school, it was a secondary school, I should point that out.
I went to a very small primary school in Carrick. We had four women teachers, and we were taught about all aspects of different religions and on appreciation of different faiths and those that have none, and in terms of sexuality. And I'm talking about being a primary school pupil in the 1980s. So, of course, maybe what the argument here is there isn't consistency across the board.
And Eamon, too, you know, every action is a reaction. I'll say that again, because if you have an opt-out system, there's children going to be taken out of certain classes. It's going to look, it's going to cause a little bit of division. And parents and guardians are going to have to familiarise themselves with these conversations, because the young ones are going to come home and say, do you know what we talked about at school today? And I am come from a household where, in my house, the word pregnant was a swear word. So, everything was expecting or Yonway or whatever. I don't know, maybe that was referring to something else. I have no clue.
But the thing about it is a lot of parents are choosing. My kids will never have a phone till they're 21 now.
Catherine,
I wouldn't be surprised.
A lot of parents are choosing to give their kids access to phones and all that goes with it. Now, they're going to get, once they have that phone in their hand, they're going to get access to the information that's not filtered, would we be better off get them in a safe environment and, educate them in such a way that, giving them the best tools to go into this big bad world.
I just think sometimes we could do some after school stuff whereby there's an after school class where we're going to be discussing this issue and this is how we're going to be discussing all of that
or my view for schools should be designed to create, to help the child go into the world, be that education, be that life skills or
that's
whatever.
That's what Leo Varadkar said. I can't believe that you and Leo Varadkar are aligned. Okay, excellent stuff. Stay where you are. Stay where you are. Deputy John McHugh, former education minister. We learnt this week almost 60 schools are being delayed. The construction projects are being delayed. Deputy McHugh, this is worrying. And a number of schools in Donegal on this list. What can we do about this?
Well, first of all, good morning, Greg. Good morning to your panel. You have a very formidable team there this morning. Good to see you all. Greg, look, it's worrying, it's concerning, and that's why I raised it this week. Now, I'm confident there will be a solution, because there has to be a solution, because each one of these schools, both nationally and within the county, are within the 2016 to 2021 capital plan. And if that is the case, that was agreed to, that's enshrined. And it's a question. The question, I believe, is how do they get out of this hole that they've found themselves in? Yes, there'll be arguments around inflation and increased costs and all the different excuses of the day. But at the end of the day, a lot of money has been spent for the likes of Ciara Maestra and Mavull Community School and the likes of St Union's is ready to go to tender. All the money going into design team, architects, planning, QS, all the preparatory work, planning stages. So it would be wrong in the widest of sense.
Is this not what the rainy day fund is for? Things like this.
Yeah, I mean, look, the problem with funding, be it right through the public sector, is they work on a yearly basis. So they're given a figure for the year, and they're trying to work within that figure. It's totally wrong. I think it's totally archaic. And when you have a situation when you have so many schools in this county that are now in the capital plan with great success stories, the likes of all those local contractors, Ponsonby and Glenswally, Dorian's in Conkill, Letterkenny, and also Boyle's up in St Mary's and now they're in Little Angels. So they're working away, they're providing employment, but they also need certainty for the next stage. So there's plenty of schools there within the bundle, but it's about having more of a long-term approach rather than this year-to-year budget. But the department, they have to come up with the money deeper, have to come up with a solution. And to the people and the parents and concerned parents, the likes of Ciara Maestra and Mavull here today, I'm saying the government has no choice but to come up with a solution.
I mean, you've got the ear of the people making the decisions. Have they given you any positive indications that these projects will proceed as planned?
Well, look, I have the ear because I make it my business to reach out. I'm not part of the parliamentary party, so I don't have that close working relationship as I had previously, but I always make it my business to reach out to people, and I'm going to continue to annoy them on this issue because it's so important.
Thanks very much for your time. I appreciate you squeezing us in. That's former Minister of Education, Deputy Joe McHugh. Okay, I just wanted to get an update. That's when he was available. There's so much more we could talk about. I'd love another hour, but unfortunately time has caught up with us again. Catherine, thank you for joining us. I really do appreciate it, and good luck with everything.
No worries.
Thanks for your time. Really do, as I say, appreciate it. Brendan, always a pleasure to hear your considered views. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Take care. And last but not least, Eamon, good stuff. Thanks very much indeed. And come here. 14's old enough for a phone, isn't it?
14?
Yeah. It's a compromise. All right, 21 it is. Good luck. Take care.
I'll come back to you when my wee one's 14, so you'll probably have the phone all right now.
All right, listen, come here. You're doing a great job nonetheless. Thank you so much indeed. Eamon McGee there. Right, let's take a break.